Now we've been expounding the big epistle of the apostle to the Romans. Began at 1:1, and now we've arrived at 5:12, and we will read through verse 14 of the epistle of Romans. Romans 5 and verse 12. Therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin was not imputed when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned, in the likeness of the offense of Adam, who is a type of him who was to come. Let's pray together. Our Heavenly Father, we confess that throughout this week we've been running about in a world that does not love you or your word. And we bless you that the doors of your house are open on this day and you invite us to come in. And we even thank you for the worship already experienced and how, as it were, you've taken our breath away, singing such things as victors, wreaths and monarchs' gems will blend in common dust. And how we confess to you, our Father, the world has told us otherwise this week. The world has told us that the beauty of the victor's wreath will never fade, and the gem of the monarch will never burn. But we bless you that even having been here for a few moments, you've already told us the truth, contrary to a lying world. And we pray that now, as we open up your word, O our Father, that you would again tell us the truth. We desperately need the truth. And we pray that we would have here the Spirit of truth that would speak through a sinner and speak to sinners, that we might glorify you and enjoy you forever. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen.
You know the account of how many centuries ago a 9-footed Philistine warrior named Goliath stood in the Valley of Elah taunting the armies of Israel with this challenge. And here was his challenge. Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. You can see him shouting to the quaking Israelite troops there on the mountain above. Choose a man for yourselves. Let him come down to me. And if he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us. So the account goes in 1 Samuel 17. And the account continues and says that after days of silence from the camp of Israel, eventually there descended from the Israelite camp into the valley a ruddy-faced, sling-carrying youth named David. And there in the valley faced off two representative champions. Goliath, representing the Philistines, and David, representing the Israelites. And the performance of each would determine the destiny of those whom they represented. All eyes were on them, on those two. And all eyes were on those two alone. Well, this drama that I've drawn with the scriptural pen well depicts the two camps of humanity who stand behind two men. There is the hell-bound camp of humanity, and there is the heaven-bound camp of humanity. And Thomas Goodwin puts it this way regarding the two champions behind each stand. In God's eyes, there are two men in all of history. Adam and Jesus Christ.
And these two men have all other men hanging from their girdle strings. We might say from their apron strings. Well, this principle of representation that I've drawn and Goodwin has spoken, this principle of representation is the theme of Romans 5, 12 through 21. As in this passage, the apostle continues to unpack the great doctrine of justification by faith. And as he's unpacking this doctrine of justification by faith, here he anticipates this objection from a skeptic Jew, as Paul has said, we are saved in Christ Jesus. As he says in 5:10, we shall be saved literally in his life. And the Jew, Paul anticipates, sitting there, responds this way in disagreement. Okay, Paul, where did you get this harebrained idea that the good deeds of one man are sufficient to justify the souls of many men? One for many? Where'd you get this idea, Paul? Did you dream it up? And basically what Paul says is, no, I didn't dream it up. I looked it up. I looked it up in your own scriptures. Because that is where this principle of representation, one acting for many, is clearly displayed. Well, with this in mind, let's go then to our passage. We're going to look at Romans 5, 12 through 14, by way of three heads of exposition. We'll look at, firstly, the declaration of one man representation in verse 12. Secondly, the verification of one man representation in verses 13 through 14a. And then lastly, the culmination of one man representation in verse 14b. And as we have time, we'll draw three lines then of application. So three and then three this morning. Let's go first of all to verse 12, our first main heading of exposition, where we see the declaration of one man representation. Paul says, therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. Where did I get this idea of one man representing the many? Well, here Paul draws from the scriptures the key precedent of one man in the Old Testament scriptures standing in the place of many. Now consider this declaration of one man representation, three elements of it here. First of all, in the case of Adam. Where did I get this idea of one for many? Right there in the beginning. In the case of Adam. That's why Paul says here, through one man sin entered the world. To what is Paul referring? Well, he's referring to Genesis chapter 3, where in the beginning we find the devil's temptation of Eve ended up in effect in the high-handed sin of Adam. Through one man sin entered the world. Sin. Now, what is sin? Well, sin, as I think the Catechism rightly describes, is a lack of conformity to the law of God. In the Garden of Eden, turn with me, if you will, to Genesis 2 and verses 16 and 17. There in the Garden of Eden, there was a law. There was a word that was given to Adam. A line was drawn in the sand. The Lord said to Adam there in 2:16, from any tree of the garden you may eat fully, but, here's a line drawn, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. There it is. That is the law. That is the commandment of God. It was a clear-cut declaration. But Adam sinned, as it says, through one man sin entered the world. What is sin but a transgression of the line drawn by the words of God? As Adam, when he took hold of the forbidden fruit and he ate it there, we find he rebelliously crossed that mine. And basically what he said is, I shall be God. I shall determine what is right or wrong for me. I shall be my own authority, and I will trash the authority of my Maker. Now, what was the penalty? Well, the penalty was clearly death, for it says there in 2:17, when you eat thereof, you shall surely die. That's why it says in Romans 5:12, through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin. Adam, upon eating, died. At least he began the death process. Death has various dimensions to it. He died in the sense of the cutting off of the relationship between himself and the living God. 3:24 in Genesis shows how he died in that he was separated from intimacy with God. He was banished from the garden, and the angel had a flashing sword that disallowed his re-entrance into communion with God. He died. He was separated from God. Also, we find Adam died in the 5th chapter. Oh, he lived to be over 900 years. But he still died as his soul was separated from his body. So there is spiritual death, there is physical death, but also there is eternal death. And eternal death is described in Revelation 20:14 as the second death, being cast into the lake of fire. When God says, when you eat of this fruit, you will surely die, it encompasses this wide dimension of death. So we see that sin and death invaded through Adam. But we'll notice, as we're looking at the declaration of one man representation in the case of Adam, sin and death did not remain isolated with Adam, but it spread. That is our second element in our heading, the declaration of one man representation, having seen in the case of Adam. Secondly, we see now in the spread of death. In the spread of death. You see, Adam in his sinning was not merely an isolated agent, sort of like the little boy in the 4th grade class. He throws a snowball out at recess. And having committed that crime, we find that the next day, because he committed the crime, he doesn't commit it isolated, because the next day the other 24 students in his class are penalized for his crime. His snowballing as a representative of the class results in the whole class being given the penalty of forfeiting their recess the next day. You see, the penalty goes to others. There is a solidarity between the criminal and those with whom he is a corporate member. And so it is with Adam. We find the text says that death spread to all, because Adam was acting as a representative for all of mankind. Adam was under a probation in the Garden of Eden, and the threat of death hung in the balance. But death not only for him, that wasn't all that was at stake. It was death for all of his children, for all of his posterity. We could say the whole class of humanity hung on his performance there in the garden. See, Adam is our father. And as a father, he was our representative. And the penalty of his eating, death, registered to the accounts of each and every child who would come from his loins. That's each and every one of us who sit in this room. You see, he is our representative. I want us to screw this tight into our mind. He stood as our representative. And what he did, the full weight of our presence was there with him. It's much like Peter Hoekstra, who represents most of those who attend this church in Washington, D.C. He is our representative. And remember a number of months ago when he registered this vote to impeach President Clinton, verifying the articles of charge? Profoundly, you, Craig, and you, Bob, and you, Ann, and you, Lorna, were there with Peter Hoekstra behind him when he cast that vote. And so, too, we were profoundly, in a legal sense, behind Adam as he cast the vote to rebel against the living God. And because he cast that vote as our representative to rebel, the penalty of that rebellion would be to the gallows you go, to death you go. Not just Adam individually, but all of his offspring corporately. For we were all represented in the garden by our Father. And that is verified by Genesis chapter 5, where yes, it says that Adam, upon being 930 years old, it says, and he died. Why? Because he sinned against the law of God, and that was a threat, and the penalty was death. But let me ask you, in Genesis chapter 5, is Adam the only one who died? No, all of his posterity died. All of his children died. Seth, yes, he lived 912 years, but it says in verse 8, and he died. Enosh, yes, 905 years, but it says, and he died. Kenan, and he died. Mahalalel, and he died. Jared, and he died. It goes on and on. There's so much blood in this passage. Why so much blood in this passage? Why so much death in this passage? Because of the penalty. Adam's guilt was attributed to the account of every one of his children, therefore, and they died. That's what Paul is saying when he says, therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin, so death spread to all men. So we've seen in the declaration of one man representation, this isn't a harebrained idea of the apostles, is it? This is one that's in the Bible. In the case of Adam, in the spread of death. Now, thirdly, as we look at our third element of the declaration of one man representation, in the universality of sin. In the universality of sin, or in the widespread character of sin. Because the verse goes on, therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world and death through sin, and so death spread to all men. Why? Because all sinned. Because all sinned. Mr. Cranfield says this, death follows sin like a shadow. So that where there is death present in one's life, whether it was Mahalalel or Jared or Methuselah, if there was death present in his life, there must also have been sin present in his life. As it says, for as death spread to all men because all sin. Well, we ask the question, in what sense is it true that in Adam all have sinned? In Adam all have sinned. Well, in what sense? And when we understand in what sense, this will be the key to the understanding of this passage, and it will enlighten our eyes regarding the nature of justification. In what sense did all sin? In what sense is there this universality of sin? Let me give you three views here. Some say, oh, that's by imitation. That's how all sinned. By imitation. Now, individuals who would be Pelagian in nature or Arminian in nature, they would have this view of it was by imitation. They would say, all men are just like Adam in that every man has a personal probation. Adam had it in Eden. You may have had it in Saginaw. You may have had it in Holland. You may have had it in Detroit. And you may have had it in Jackson. And you may have had it out in Oregon. But everybody has an individual probation. And so we find they in their lives are given commandments. And the enemy would come and tempt to eat the forbidden fruit of disobedience. And therefore, in each individual's life, born somewhat neutral, even good like Adam, ironically, and even somewhat poetically, we all seem to imitate Adam and what he did. They would say it's sort of like the 9-year-old girl, and she's left alone to babysit her 3 younger siblings, is Mom and Dad go off for coffee just for 45 minutes. And the last thing Mom and Dad say to the 9-year-old girl is, remember, don't turn on the television set. There's a very clear line that's been drawn. Maybe for her life, this is the first time such a clear line has been drawn. At that point, after they leave, the forbidden fruit of the on button is so sweet and tempting, she ends up turning it on, and there it is, by way of imitation, she follows and sins in Adam in the sense that she imitates him. Let me ask, do you think that's true? Do you think that's what he's speaking about, if in Adam all sinned because of mere imitation? I don't think so at all. Because let's check the issue of death. Remember what I said, Paul says, where there is death present, there must also be sin present. There was a time a number of years ago when I was in the hospital room where a little baby was born with a severe birth defect. And I saw that the baby was about 40 minutes old. The mother and father were holding the little baby. And we prayed over that little baby. But after I left, that little baby, within the next hour and 15 minutes, died. Now, there was death in that hospital room, but let me ask you, had that little baby sinned? I mean, which of the Ten Commandments would you charge against that little baby? That little baby sinned. There was death. Excuse me, that little baby died. There was death in that room, but in a sense, that little baby never imitated Adam in sinning. And so, too, I believe that's not what the apostle is talking about. As he spoke about how death came to all men because all sinned. You see, more conclusive even than my baby argument would be the context here, where in the context this idea of imitation fails to recognize the direct cause and effect relationship between Adam's personal sin and the curse of death that spread to all men. There's an intimate relationship between Adam's sin personally and death's spread universally. Notice with me in 5:15 of Romans. Notice the agency of Adam resulting in death. It says, but the free gift is not like the transgression. For if by the transgression, that would be Adam's sin, if by the transgression of the one the many died, you see what it's saying is Adam did something that directly caused, the direct effect was the death of many. Or look at verse 17. For if by the transgression of the one, death reigned through the one. You see, because someone dies, it's not initially and fundamentally because of personal imitation. There's another issue that is at stake in this phrase, because all sin. Therefore, when we look at the universality of sin, we would set aside the view that this is mere imitation. Well, what does it mean then? All sinned in Adam. Some would say, well, that's not by imitation, but by pollution. By pollution. And they would say, all sinned in the sense that we all inherit sinful genes from Adam. Sinful chromosomes, as it were. We're all born with a bad heart. There is, because Adam is our great-great-great-great-great-great and beyond grandfather, we find that Adam has mysteriously passed on to us a corrupt nature, a bad root. And therefore this bad root of our bad heart produces bad fruit. And because we produce this bad fruit, therefore, we all die. Now, I don't deny the reality of total depravity. That teaching is true, but I don't think that's what Paul is talking about here, are having a corrupt nature inherited from Adam. That is inconsistent with the parallel between Adam's disobedience and Christ's obedience. Because we find Adam's sin, if according to this idea, gives us depravity, and then the bad heart produces the bad fruit. Somehow I'm condemned because of what I did alone, my bad fruit. Then, if we would draw the parallel, because the parallel throughout this passage is drawn with Christ, somehow Christ has given me not degeneration, but regeneration. He's given me a good heart. Then from that good heart sprouts good fruit.
And then because of the good fruit I bear, the good deeds I do, I earn the favor of God. Salvation by works. You know who teaches that? The Roman Catholics teach that. They will teach that we are infused, supposedly, with a good heart. And then by the doing of good deeds, we are able to justify ourselves by our good deeds in that sense. But I don't believe this is speaking about merely dying and sinning because of pollution. The argument of 5:18 and 19 would knock that down. Look what it says in 5:18. So then as to the transgression of one, there resulted condemnation to all men. Even so, through one act of righteousness, there resulted justification of life to all men. For as through the one man's disobedience, Adam, the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of the one, the many will be made righteous. Is it through the obedience of me and the fruits of obedience that I am going to be saved? No, it's by the obedience of the one Christ that I can be saved. You see, we're not justified by personal being and doing, but whether we're justified by Christ's being and doing. The one and the many representation. Therefore, I believe, as we're asking this question in the universality of sin, in what sense have all sinned? It's not by imitation. It's not by pollution. It's by representation. It's by representation. Just as David represented Israel in the valley of Elah, and just as the whole nation of Israel's destiny hinged on David's performance, so too Adam was there in Eden as the father of his children, and all of our destinies hinged on the performance of Adam, the one man who was our father. The children's little motto is a very accurate one. It says, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. That's what he's saying. In Adam's fall, we sinned all. God appointed Adam as our representative head. And as he went down there in the valley of Eden, all eyes, as it were, if we were all conscious enough to have eyes, all eyes are on him and on his performance. That's why it says, all sinned. Sinned legally. And his sin was imputed legally. It was reckoned to our account. So that we find that to a little child's account, when a little baby is born, he is born and upon conception, that little baby's slate is not clean. It is not white. It is not innocent. There is a bad stain on it. And the bad stain says, treasonous rebel. Where'd that come from? It came from Adam's representation in the valley of Eden. And therefore, because a child is a treasonous rebel, the child is worthy of death. Representation. You know, children, about this representation thing? You're on the soccer field and you're one down and the clock is gone, but there's a foul in the box and there's a penalty kick. And one of the 18 men of your team is chosen to kick the penalty kick. One of the 18. And there he is standing there. And all of the season rides on what that one person does. And all eyes are on that one person. And if he makes it, you may go into overtime and win the whole thing. But if he misses it, you all lose. And so it was for Adam's performance in the Garden of Eden. He sinned. He rebelled against God. We all lose. And are on our way to the gallows of destruction. You see, so it is with the first Adam, by representation, legal representation. And so it is with the second Adam, legal representation. So that is the declaration of one man representation. Come with me now, secondly, in verses 13 and 14a, the verification of one man representation. The verification of one man representation. Well, at this point, someone may cry, foul! This isn't fair, says the proud-hearted man who objects. Why do I have to be subjected to this representation thing anyway? And this comes from the heart of a man who is a self-made man. And he says, If it were fair, I would be judged by my own merits and not by some appointed proxy who stood representing me. If that would be fairness, if fairness would be given, that would be the situation. This whole idea of representation just can't be true. And here now, in 13 through 14a, Paul verifies the idea of one man representation. Notice three assertions here. First, pre-Mosaic ignorance. Pre-Mosaic ignorance. He says this, "For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin was not imputed where there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam, who was a type of the one who was to come." Paul speaks, first of all, by way of assertion of pre-Mosaic ignorance. Before Moses came, there was a lot of ignorance in the world regarding the law, the lines drawn in the sand, as it were. It says in Luke 12 and verse 48, "To whom much is given, much is required." Simply what that means is knowledge brings liability. And before a line is drawn, before knowledge is there, we're really not liable. If there was a new school that was built up on a Quincy, you usually go by that area 55 miles per hour, but a new school is built there, and they got some yellow signs up that say school and maybe even flashing yellow lights, but the new sign hasn't yet been posted 25 miles per hour. And if you fly by that school at the old 55, a police officer stops you and you say, "But the sign hasn't been posted yet." But he says, "Look, there are flashing lights there, and you saw the kids were coming out of the school, but the sign hasn't been posted." He would say, "Well, it's true. The sign hasn't been posted yet. It's supposed to come up tomorrow. You're not liable yet, but tomorrow you will be." And in a profound sense, this is the way it was before the law came during the time of Moses. You see, before the sign of God's law was erected, sin was in the world, Paul says. Notice how it says, "For until the law, sin was in the world." People were sinning. But the law was not yet sin was not yet imputed where there is no law. You see, people didn't yet sin high-handedly until the law came. They didn't have the knowledge, "To whom much is given, much is required." You see, willful obedience was not yet clear-cut. That's why it says sinned in the likeness of Adam. Adam sinned because he saw the line was drawn right by the finger of God. You cannot cross this line and eat that fruit from that tree. Now it's true, Paul says, sin was in the world. And before the law ever came, the individual who lived off in Egypt, who lived off in Britannia and England, there was a conscience, right? 2:14 and 15 say the Gentiles who do not have the law have the law in their heart. But that isn't clearly posted in the likeness of Adam. Yes, sin was in the world as there was this pre-Mosaic ignorance, but people couldn't sin as cold-bloodedly as they did in the time of Adam. So that is the idea of pre-Mosaic ignorance. But the second assertion, as he's verifying one-man representation, is pre-Mosaic death. There was pre-Mosaic death. Yet, though sin was in the world because of conscience, men knew that they were violating their consciences, yet there was no before Sinai, there was yet not the special revelation posting of the law of God, which would say, "Thus you must do, and if you don't do it, you will die." The law would always say, "Do and live. Do and live," when Moses came down from the mountain. But before Sinai ever occurred, interesting how people still died, didn't they? People still died. We saw that in Genesis chapter 5, Jared died, and Methuselah died, and Kenan died. And in Genesis 19, in Sodom and Gomorrah, the whole city died. And before the flood, all those wicked people, they died. The person who was on the top of the mountain when the floodwaters were coming up, maybe even clinging to a tree, that person had not sinned in the likeness of Adam, with a clear line having been drawn, but he still died. Why did he die? Because of the sin of Adam. The sin of Adam was charged to his account. But like Jonah 4:11, but that man didn't know his right hand from his left. That's right, he didn't. He didn't sin in the likeness of Adam. The sign hadn't been posted clearly, except in his conscience, which was foggily. But still, he died. Who is the culprit then for his death? It's Adam. Adam was the ultimate culprit, and that is then, having seen pre-Mosaic ignorance, pre-Mosaic death. Now the third assertion in this verification is Adamic imputation. Adamic imputation. As it says there, nevertheless death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam. You see, Adam in the garden, in probation, he represented his offspring. He represented Seth and Jared and Methuselah and the mountaintop victim and Lot's wife. And all of these individuals who died, died because Adam's sin was applied to their account. And therefore, the penalty of death hit them right between the eyes. John Murray puts it this way: the only explanation of the universal reign of death is solidarity in the sin of Adam. Like it or not, that's a reality. We die ultimately and fundamentally because Adam's sin is legally charged to our account. So we've seen the declaration of one man representation, the verification of one man representation. Now, thirdly and finally, the culmination of one man representation. That's just the last phrase in 14b. Adam, who is a type of him who was to come. In this, Paul's argument culminates. It comes to a crescendo. We find that Adam is a type of him who was to come. Adam is a mold, as it were, of one who would come. And who is the one who would come? Jesus. Adam, we find, set a mold or a framework in the sense of one man worked widespread ruin. Christ will come in that same mold where one man is going to work widespread, not ruin, but in the same mold, one for the many, he will come and work widespread salvation. And on, Paul will argue, like in 5:19 of Romans, for as to the one man's disobedience, the many, see the one and the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of the one, the many will be made righteous. You see, though there is much in common and parallel, the one and the many, there's great divergence. Because Adam's performance, the first Adam, brought death. Christ, the second Adam's performance, will not bring death. Will bring the polar opposite. It will bring life. So you see how profoundly, in God's eyes, there are two men. Jesus Christ, the second Adam, and Adam, the first Adam. And we all put then for his death. It's Adam. Adam was the ultimate culprit, and that is then, having seen pre-Mosaic ignorance, pre-Mosaic death. Now the third assertion in this verification is Adamic imputation. Adamic imputation. As it says there, nevertheless death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam. You see, Adam in the garden, in probation, he represented his offspring. He represented Seth and Jared and Methuselah and the mountaintop victim and Lot's wife. And all of these individuals who died, died because Adam's sin was applied to their account. And therefore, the penalty of death hit them right between the eyes. John Murray puts it this way: the only explanation of the universal reign of death is solidarity in the sin of Adam. Like it or not, that's a reality. We die ultimately and fundamentally because Adam's sin is legally charged to our account. So we've seen the declaration of one man representation, the verification of one man representation. Now, thirdly and finally, the culmination of one man representation. That's just the last phrase in 14b. Adam, who is a type of him who was to come. In this, Paul's argument culminates. It comes to a crescendo. We find that Adam is a type of him who was to come. Adam is a mold, as it were, of one who would come. And who is the one who would come? Jesus. Adam, we find, set a mold or a framework in the sense of one man worked widespread ruin. Christ will come in that same mold where one man is going to work widespread, not ruin, but in the same mold, one for the many, he will come and work widespread salvation. And on, Paul will argue, like in 5:19 of Romans, or as through the one man's disobedience, the many, see the one and the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of the one, the many will be made righteous. You see, though there is much in common and parallel, the one and the many, there's great divergence. Because Adam's performance, the first Adam, brought death. Christ, the second Adam's performance, will not bring death. Will bring the polar opposite. It will bring life. So you see how profoundly, in God's eyes, there are two men. Jesus Christ, the second Adam, and Adam, the first Adam. And we all put then for his death. It's Adam. Adam was the ultimate culprit, and that is then, having seen pre-Mosaic ignorance, pre-Mosaic death. Now the third assertion in this verification is Adamic imputation. Adamic imputation. As it says there, nevertheless death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam. You see, Adam in the garden, in probation, he represented his offspring. He represented Seth and Jared and Methuselah and the mountaintop victim and Lot's wife. And all of these individuals who died, died because Adam's sin was applied to their account. And therefore, the penalty of death hit them right between the eyes. John Murray puts it this way: the only explanation of the universal reign of death is solidarity in the sin of Adam. Like it or not, that's a reality. We die ultimately and fundamentally because Adam's sin is legally charged to our account. So we've seen the declaration of one man representation, the verification of one man representation. Now, thirdly and finally, the culmination of one man representation. That's just the last phrase in 14b. Adam, who is a type of him who was to come? In this, Paul's argument culminates. It comes to a crescendo. We find that Adam is a type of him who was to come. Adam is a mold, as it were, of one who would come. And who is the one who would come? Jesus. Adam, we find, set a mold or a framework in the sense of one man worked widespread ruin. Christ will come in that same mold where one man is going to work widespread, not ruin, but in the same mold, one for the many, he will come and work widespread salvation. And on, Paul will argue, like in 5:19 of Romans, or as through the one man's disobedience, the many, see the one and the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of the one, the many will be made righteous. You see, though there is much in common and parallel, the one and the many, there's great divergence. Because Adam's performance, the first Adam, brought death. Christ, the second Adam's performance, will not bring death. Will bring the polar opposite. It will bring life. So you see how profoundly, in God's eyes, there are two men. Jesus Christ, the second Adam, and Adam, the first Adam. And we all pretend for his death.
It's Adam.
Adam was the ultimate culprit. And that is then, having seen pre-Mosaic ignorance, pre-Mosaic death. Now the third assertion in this verification is Adamic imputation. Adamic imputation. As it says there, nevertheless, death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam. You see, Adam in the garden, in probation, he represented his offspring. He represented Seth and Jared and Methuselah and the mountaintop victim and Lot's wife. And all of these individuals who died, died because Adam's sin was applied to their account. And therefore, the penalty of death hit them right between the eyes. John Murray puts it this way: the only explanation of the universal reign of death is solidarity in the sin of Adam. Like it or not, that's a reality. We die ultimately and fundamentally because Adam's sin is legally charged to our account. So we've seen the declaration of one man representation, the verification of one man representation. Now, thirdly and finally, the culmination of one man representation. That's just the last phrase in 14b. Adam, who is a type of him who was to come. In this, Paul's argument culminates. It comes to a crescendo. We find that Adam is a type of him who was to come. Adam is a mold, as it were, of one who would come. And who is the one who would come? Jesus. Adam, we find, set a mold or a framework in the sense of one man worked widespread ruin. Christ will come in that same mold where one man is going to work widespread, not ruin, but in the same mold, one for the many, he will come and work widespread salvation. And on, Paul will argue, like in 5:19 of Romans, or as through the one man's disobedience, the many, see the one and the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of the one, the many will be made righteous. You see, though there is much in common and parallel, the one and the many, there's great divergence. Because Adam's performance, the first Adam, brought death. Christ, the second Adam's performance, will not bring death. It will bring the polar opposite. It will bring life. So you see how profoundly, in God's eyes, there are two men. Jesus Christ, the second Adam, and Adam, the first Adam. And we all pretend for his death. It's Adam. Adam was the ultimate culprit. And that is then, having seen pre-Mosaic ignorance, pre-Mosaic death. Now the third assertion in this verification is Adamic imputation. Adamic imputation. As it says there, nevertheless, death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam. You see, Adam in the garden, in probation, he represented his offspring. He represented Seth and Jared and Methuselah and the mountaintop victim and Lot's wife. And all of these individuals who died, died because Adam's sin was applied to their account. And therefore, the penalty of death hit them right between the eyes. John Murray puts it this way: the only explanation of the universal reign of death is solidarity in the sin of Adam. Like it or not, that's a reality. We die ultimately and fundamentally because Adam's sin is legally charged to our account. So we've seen the declaration of one man representation, the verification of one man representation. Now, thirdly and finally, the culmination of one man representation. That's just the last phrase in 14b. Adam, who is a type of him who was to come. In this, Paul's argument culminates. It comes to a crescendo. We find that Adam is a type of him who was to come. Adam is a mold, as it were, of one who would come. And who is the one who would come? Jesus. Adam, we find, set a mold or a framework in the sense of one man worked widespread ruin. Christ will come in that same mold where one man is going to work widespread, not ruin, but in the same mold, one for the many, he will come and work widespread salvation. And on, Paul will argue, like in 5:19 of Romans, for as through the one man's disobedience, the many, through the one and the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of the one, the many will be made righteous. You see, though there is much in common and parallel, the one and the many, there's great divergence. Because Adam's performance, the first Adam, brought death. Christ, the second Adam's performance, will not bring death. It will bring the polar opposite. It will bring life. So you see how profoundly, in God's eyes, there are two men. Jesus Christ, the second Adam, and Adam, the first Adam. And we all put them for his death. It's Adam. Adam was the ultimate culprit, and that is then, having seen pre-Mosaic ignorance, pre-Mosaic death. Now the third assertion in this verification is Adamic imputation. Adamic imputation. As it says there, nevertheless death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam. You see, Adam in the garden, in probation, he represented his offspring. He represented Seth and Jared and Methuselah and the mountaintop victim and Lot's wife. And all of these individuals who died, died because Adam's sin was applied to their account. And therefore, the penalty of death hit them right between the eyes. John Murray puts it this way: the only explanation of the universal reign of death is solidarity in the sin of Adam. Like it or not, that's a reality. We die ultimately and fundamentally because Adam's sin is legally charged to our account. So we've seen the declaration of one man representation, the verification of one man representation. Now, thirdly and finally, the culmination of one man representation. That's just the last phrase in 14b. Adam, who is a type of him who was to come. In this, Paul's argument culminates. It comes to a crescendo. We find that Adam is a type of him who was to come. Adam is a mold, as it were, of one who would come. And who is the one who would come? Jesus. Adam, we find, set a mold or a framework in the sense of one man worked widespread ruin. Christ will come in that same mold where one man is going to work widespread, not ruin, but in the same mold, one for the many, he will come and work widespread salvation. And on, Paul will argue, like in 5:19 of Romans, for as through the one man's disobedience, the many, through the one and the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of the one, the many will be made righteous. You see, though there is much in common and parallel, the one and the many, there's great divergence. Because Adam's performance, the first Adam, brought death. Christ, the second Adam's performance, will not bring death. It will bring the polar opposite. It will bring life. So you see how profoundly, in God's eyes, there are two men. Jesus Christ, the second Adam, and Adam, the first Adam. And we all put them for his death. It's Adam. Adam was the ultimate culprit, and that is then, having seen pre-Mosaic ignorance, pre-Mosaic death. Now the third assertion in this verification is Adamic imputation. Adamic imputation. As it says there, nevertheless death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam. You see, Adam in the garden, in probation, he represented his offspring. He represented Seth and Jared and Methuselah and the mountaintop victim and Lot's wife. And all of these individuals who died, died because Adam's sin was applied to their account. And therefore, the penalty of death hit them right between the eyes. John Murray puts it this way: the only explanation of the universal reign of death is solidarity in the sin of Adam. Like it or not, that's a reality. We die ultimately and fundamentally because Adam's sin is legally charged to our account. So we've seen the declaration of one man representation, the verification of one man representation. Now, thirdly and finally, the culmination of one man representation. That's just the last phrase in 14b. Adam, who is a type of him who was to come. In this, Paul's argument culminates. It comes to a crescendo. We find that Adam is a type of him who was to come. Adam is a mold, as it were, of one who would come. And who is the one who would come? Jesus. Adam, we find, set a mold or a framework in the sense of one man worked widespread ruin. Christ will come in that same mold where one man is going to work widespread, not ruin, but in the same mold, one for the many, he will come and work widespread salvation. And on, Paul will argue, like in 5:19 of Romans, for as through the one man's disobedience, the many, see the one and the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of the one, the many will be made righteous. You see, though there is much in common and parallel, the one and the many, there's great divergence. Because Adam's performance, the first Adam, brought death. Christ, the second Adam's performance, will not bring death. It will bring the polar opposite. It will bring life. So you see how profoundly, in God's eyes, there are two men. Jesus Christ, the second Adam, and Adam, the first Adam. And we all put then for his death. It's Adam. Adam was the ultimate culprit, and that is then, having seen pre-Mosaic ignorance, pre-Mosaic death. Now the third assertion in this verification is Adamic imputation. Adamic imputation. As it says there, nevertheless death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam. You see, Adam in the garden, in probation, he represented his offspring. He represented Seth and Jared and Methuselah and the mountaintop victim and Lot's wife. And all of these individuals who died, died because Adam's sin was applied to their account. And therefore, the penalty of death hit them right between the eyes. John Murray puts it this way: the only explanation of the universal reign of death is solidarity in the sin of Adam. Like it or not, that's a reality. We die ultimately and fundamentally because Adam's sin is legally charged to our account. So we've seen the declaration of one man representation, the verification of one man representation. Now, thirdly and finally, the culmination of one man representation. That's just the last phrase in 14b. Adam, who is a type of him who was to come? In this, Paul's argument culminates. It comes to a crescendo. We find that Adam is a type of him who was to come. Adam is a mold, as it were, of one who would come. And who is the one who would come? Jesus. Adam, we find, set a mold or a framework in the sense of one man worked widespread ruin. Christ will come in that same mold where one man is going to work widespread, not ruin, but in the same mold, one for the many, he will come and work widespread salvation. And on, Paul will argue, like in 5:19 of Romans, or as through the one man's disobedience, the many, see the one and the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of the one, the many will be made righteous. You see, though there is much in common and parallel, the one and the many, there's great divergence. Because Adam's performance, the first Adam, brought death. Christ, the second Adam's performance, will not bring death. It will bring the polar opposite. It will bring life. So you see how profoundly, in God's eyes, there are two men. Jesus Christ, the second Adam, and Adam, the first Adam. And we all put then for his death. It's Adam. Adam was the ultimate culprit, and that is then, having seen pre-Mosaic ignorance, pre-Mosaic death. Now the third assertion in this verification is Adamic imputation. Adamic imputation. As it says there, nevertheless death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam. You see, Adam in the garden, in probation, he represented his offspring. He represented Seth and Jared and Methuselah and the mountaintop victim and Lot's wife. And all of these individuals who died because Adam's sin was applied to their account. And therefore, the penalty of death hit them right between the eyes. John Murray puts it this way: the only explanation of the universal reign of death is solidarity in the sin of Adam. Like it or not, that's a reality. We die ultimately and fundamentally because Adam's sin is legally charged to our account. So we've seen the declaration of one man representation, the verification of one man representation. Now, thirdly and finally, the culmination of one man representation. That's just the last phrase in 14b. Adam, who is a type of him who was to come. In this, Paul's argument culminates. It comes to a crescendo. We find that Adam is a type of him who was to come. Adam is a mold, as it were, of one who would come. And who is the one who would come? Jesus. Adam, we find, set a mold or a framework in the sense of one man worked widespread ruin. Christ will come in that same mold where one man is going to work widespread, not ruin, but in the same mold, one for the many, he will come and work widespread salvation. And on, Paul will argue, like in 5:19 of Romans, or as through the one man's disobedience, the many, see the one and the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of the one, the many will be made righteous. You see, though there is much in common and parallel, the one and the many, there's great divergence. Because Adam's performance, the first Adam, brought death. Christ, the second Adam's performance, will not bring death. Will bring the polar opposite. It will bring life. So you see how profoundly, in God's eyes, there are two men. Jesus Christ, the second Adam, and Adam, the first Adam. And we all put then for his death. It's Adam. Adam was the ultimate culprit, and that is then, having seen pre-Mosaic ignorance, pre-Mosaic death. Now the third assertion in this verification is Adamic imputation. Adamic imputation. As it says there, nevertheless death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam. You see, Adam in the garden, in probation, he represented his offspring. He represented Seth and Jared and Methuselah and the mountaintop victim and Lot's wife. And all of these individuals who died because Adam's sin was applied to their account. And therefore, the penalty of death hit them right between the eyes. John Murray puts it this way: the only explanation of the universal reign of death is solidarity in the sin of Adam. Like it or not, that's a reality. We die ultimately and fundamentally because Adam's sin is legally charged to our account. So we've seen the declaration of one man representation, the verification of one man representation. Now, thirdly and finally, the culmination of one man representation. That's just the last phrase in 14b. Adam, who is a type of him who was to come. In this, Paul's argument culminates. It comes to a crescendo. We find that Adam is a type of him who was to come. Adam is a mold, as it were, of one who would come. And who is the one who would come? Jesus. Adam, we find, set a mold or a framework in the sense of one man worked widespread ruin. Christ will come in that same mold where one man is going to work widespread, not ruin, but in the same mold, one for the many, he will come and work widespread salvation. And on, Paul will argue, like in 5:19 of Romans, or as to the one man's disobedience, the many, see the one and the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of the one, the many will be made righteous. You see, though there is much in common and parallel, the one and the many, there's great divergence. Because Adam's performance, the first Adam, brought death. Christ, the second Adam's performance, will not bring death. It will bring the polar opposite. It will bring life. So you see how profoundly, in God's eyes, there are two men. Jesus Christ, the second Adam, and Adam, the first Adam. And we all put then for his death. It's Adam. Adam was the ultimate culprit. And that is then, having seen pre-Mosaic ignorance, pre-Mosaic death, now the third assertion in this verification is Adamic imputation. Adamic imputation. As it says there, nevertheless death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam. You see, Adam in the garden, in probation, he represented his offspring. He represented Seth and Jared and Methuselah and the mountaintop victim and Lot's wife.